session number 6447, Route 2.
Colonel John Roberts, take 2. Now, I've described the journey down so far in QE2, and I've described the transfer at South Georgia. I've also mentioned, of course, that we were in touch, to a certain extent, with what was going on through the World Service, in that we heard on the 21st of May that that had been D-Day, and I say had been because we heard afterwards, and we heard about the landings, we heard about the ships that had been hit, Ardent, Argonaut, and Antrim. What I didn't then say was that the 22nd, the following day, the day after D-Day, was A, my birthday, and B, the day that the task force was officially put on active service, or Fire Brigade, certainly, was put on active service on the 22nd of May. The other thing I failed to mention, of course, was that we arrived at South Georgia, as I've said, on the evening of the 27th in the fog, and we then did our transfers. But the following day, the 28th, just before we sailed away towards the Falklands, we learned about the attack on Goose Green, the successful attack on Goose Green. So we knew all about that. And again, it served to show us the reality of what we were doing, because we hadn't seen anything remotely like, there was no form of action of any sort. The nearest thing we saw, which was really quite curious, was that when the party I described transferred to the destroyer HMS Antrim on the 27th, the day before we got to Georgia, one or two people noticed very quickly that Antrim had got a few holes in the side that hadn't been put there by the manufacturers. And out came the binoculars and the telephoto lens, and my God, yes they were bullet holes and cannon holes. And of course we'd heard, then we remembered that we'd heard that on D-Day Antrim had collected a couple of unexploded bombs. And suddenly, here was reality. Here was a ship that had actually been attacked and had holes in it. And there she was, sitting across the water from us, taking this recce party of ours. So and that was, of course, on the 27th, and then I've described arriving on the 28th, the Georgia transfer on the 28th, and going off on this small ferry, Norland, with the Gurkhas. Now, we sailed off on the evening of the 28th. Sometime during the day of the 29th, I can't remember, we were amazed to see Canberra steaming past us in the opposite direction. I can't remember which direction we were going, because we kept turning around and going in small circles, and we got lots of instructions for changes of course without explanation, which they had to be, of course. And as we were chopping and changing course, at one stage we saw Canberra sailing almost within stone's throwing distance, exactly the opposite direction. We weren't sure if we were going away from the war and Canberra was going toward it, or the other way around. But Canberra had the bulk of the brigade on. The same day, the 29th, we heard a very sad message, which was a May Day message from a British tanker saying that she was under attack, that she was being bombed, in fact, by an aircraft. And this was a very, very sobering message to us, because we were on the bridge, Norland, at the time. And we realised two things. Firstly, we could not in any way respond to this request for help. We couldn't reply on the radio for fear of giving ourselves away and the battalion that was in the ship with us. Nor could we go to her assistance, because again, we might have led ourselves direct, we might have gone straight into a trap. And of course there was also the thought that perhaps this signal hadn't emanated from the ship at all, but was a hoax in order to draw us into an area, because when you're in a ship, you don't appreciate quite how big the ocean is. It's only when you're outside a ship, looking for a ship, that you see how big the water is, and it's almost impossible to find a ship, particularly when you've got limited fuel on an aircraft. And if you can lure ships to certain points, it's far easier. So we were concerned about that. We later learned, in fact, that the tanker was actually attacked by an Argentinian Hercules that, I gather, just threw bombs out of the back, but missed, happily. On the 31st of May, we had an aircraft, a Lynx helicopter, arrived. Again, we were a little anxious. We saw this thing coming towards us. It was clearly an aeroplane. We didn't know of any aeroplanes in the in the vicinity. As it got closer, we saw it was a helicopter. There was no way at all we could tell whose side this helicopter belonged to. All we knew was that it was flying straight at us. And when it arrived, it was a Royal Navy Lynx. And it couldn't actually land because at the time we were in a Force 9 gale and the ship was bucking like a bronco and the aircraft couldn't land. But the pilot scribbled something on a pad on his knee, tore it off, gave it to one of the sailors who ran up to the bridge where I was actually with the ship's master and David Morgan, who commands 1st 7th Gurkhas. And the little note just said on it, 1727, bridge, very urgent. From Commanding Officer Brilliant, please make maximum possible speed, course 280 degrees, and keep going for Falkland Sound. Brilliant and the other ships are making slow speed west, waiting for you. Essential you go in tonight. That was the end of the message. And we read this, and we clearly realised we were going to Falklands now. We knew we were going, as it said, in tonight, but we weren't sure quite where. We just knew we had to find these other ships and that they would lead us. And indeed they did. And on the morning of the 1st of June, we pulled into San Carlos water and dropped anchor. And we'd been practicing over the course of this last two or three days. We'd been practicing the offloading from the ship, which we thought would take place into landing craft. Norland is a roll-on, roll-off North Sea ferry, but she also has large doors at the side. And we'd been practicing going down in sticks of men, in landing craft sized chunks of people, and in fact we could get the whole of my unit onto one landing craft. It takes roughly a company strength, and we went down, and it was only at this stage that or rather the day or two before that I'd realised that I didn't have a helmet, because most of our kit was loaded on the ferries and not on QE2, and we'd yet to meet the ferries with our kit. I'd also had yet to meet my own vehicle, my own Land Rover, which had with it certain parts of my own kit, including my helmet. So on the great landing, and the great landing, of course, was the 21st of May with the Commander Brigade, but on Five Brigade's great landing, on the 1st of June, there was one man in our landing craft that didn't have a tin hat, and that was the commanding officer. I like to think that it appeared that I was leading my men in a way that was sort of recognisable to all of them. But in fact, it was a very funny feeling because we were told as we got off the ship, in fact, the brigade commander came aboard and told me that he'd need me to set up the dressing station at Goose Green, but that he needed my surgeons to reinforce Rick Jolly's surgeons at Ajax Bay. Now, in order to do these two tasks, it would mean dropping part of the unit at Red Beach, where Rick Jolly was, and the remainder at Blue Beach, which is where I had to form up prior to going down to Goose Green. And I decided, in fact, to take the whole unit over to Rick Jolly's side to find out from him, he being the medical officer on the ground at the time, exactly what the picture was. So I took the whole unit over to Rick Jolly, saw him, and he said, no, we don't need you. We're very tired, yes, but our men will cope, and really, you ought to be on the other side, preparing to move off down to Goose Green. So we then crossed the bay yet again, and it really was most strange, because I expected to come off that ship and see the sort of classic mushrooms and water spouts of bombs and D-Days and Dunkirks and all rolled into one, and wondering how I was going to cope without my tin hat. And in fact, there was nothing. It was deathly quiet. There was a slight sea mist. It was quite dark, being early morning. I don't mean dark, but a sort of twilighty sort of thing, dawn. And it was very quiet indeed. And we motored back across the bay. I'm sure the coxswain of the LCU thought I'd gone mad, and then couldn't work out one side of the bay from the other. But we went across the other side, where I saw Roger, who happily told me that he'd arranged for us all to stay at either a farmhouse or a schoolhouse or so on. And this we did, and we sort of lagered up at San Carlos settlement for the next, this was the first, up until about the 5th, while we consolidated our kit, and while the ferries arrived, and the kit arrived, and my sections joined me, and we all had a little happy reunion. until the 6th of June, when I was ordered to send forward an advanced dressing station, or a medical presence, I think I was told, to go forward to Fitzroy Settlement. And so I deployed forward the advanced dressing station under my MTO, my transport officer, Paul de Roy. And there were 26 men in all, plus I added to them one theatre technician, my senior theatre technician, and his instructions were quite clear. He was to go to Fitzroy with the advanced dressing station, search around Fitzroy, find a suitable building, and I suggested the community centre because I knew there was one, because we had a bit of paper that told us so. Go and look at it and see if it was suitable for surgery, and if it were, then he was to come back and tell me this. And with this, I dispatched them. They didn't get terribly far. They got as far as the other side of San Carlos Settlement, where they all stood in a row in pouring, I was going to say rain, sleet, in fact, while the helicopters arrived to take them. One load, that was about 8 men, I think, managed to get into a seeking helicopter, and they disappeared into the murk. The others were told there was no more flying, and rather dejectedly they started to walk back to join the rest of us. They'd completed their journey back to us, and they were then told, no, you're going by boat. So they then turned and walked back to Blue Beach, got onto a small landing craft, an LCVP it's called, and they then went out to Sir Tristram. And they loaded onto Sir Tristram, and they then sailed off round to Fitzroy. And in order to go to Fitzroy, of course, the shorter journey would have been to have gone round the north of East Island, but that would have meant going past Port Stanley, and we knew that the Argentinians had got shore-based Exocet all around Stanley. So they had to go the long way, which is right the way down Falkland Sound between the two islands, right round the southernmost tip of East Falkland, all the way up the east side of East Falkland Island and into Fitzroy. It was, I gather, not a very pleasant journey for him, and I gathered even more so the next night because we did it. But it's quite calm going down Falkland Sound, and it's only when you get out of the sound at the bottom that the Force Nines begin to take effect, and sailing in an LSL is rather like a mess, sailing in a mess tin. They're flat-bottomed and they don't like waves. So the advanced dressing station went complete, partly by helicopter, and I gather from them that they had the most hellish journey because the sleet was coming down, night had fallen, the pilot was flying. A lot of them said he was flying so low they believed he was actually underground half the trip. They said they were never more terrified in their lives of that particular journey. But they arrived, and they began to set up, this just this 8 men. And then the next morning, of course, Tristram had arrived and offloaded the remainder. So they had the 27 of them, and they set up two 12 by 12 foot tents. And this was the advanced dressing station. They had a very small amount of kit with them, which was man-packed in Bergens. The senior technician, Mr. Viner, then managed to get himself on a returning helicopter and came back to see me, and he arrived back on the 7th. And on the 7th, at 3:05 in the afternoon, I was told that at 3:30 I was to be loaded onto Sir Galahad. Now, it's quite impossible to load a unit complete with all its equipment, all its pallets, its two operating theatres, and what did I have? 3 Land Rovers and 5 trailers, including blood container trailers. It is quite impossible to do this in half an hour. This was pointed out, and we were told, well, fine, all right, you can slip it by 2 hours and start to load at 5:30. That was far more feasible, so we lined up. We got down to Blue Beach to find that the only form of conveyance which could take us out to Sir Galahad was a large Mexifloat. And a Mexifloat, if you don't know, a Mexifloat is rather like a series of large hollow metal Weetabixes all fastened together, and it'll sort of ripple over the water. It's got engines on the back of it and a sort of flat ramp at the front. It's the most extraordinary, ungainly looking beast, but it amazingly carries out its function and will carry large quantities of men and equipment. When I got down to the beach, My men had already started loading onto this float, and we already had, I think, 5 or 6 pallets of medical kit on there. But what was worse was on this float, the float itself was about a third full, starting from the engine end, of ammunition. Tons upon tons of ammunition were on this float. And it was quite obvious that I couldn't get the unit onto this float. And so I had to have my pallets, which had been loaded, taken off. And I said that that float had to be offloaded of its ammunition. The ammunition was to be stacked. Nobody, incidentally, knew who it belonged to. It was just ammunition sitting on a float. And even the coxswain of the float didn't know where it had come from or where it was going. But clearly it couldn't stay there if I was to get the unit on. So the one eager beaver driver rather grumpily started to offload the things that he'd just been loading. And I managed to find a second eager beaver and hailed a passing soldier who forcefully said that it wasn't his eager beaver, but rapidly learned that it was, got on the eager beaver, and the two of them together, in concert, managed to offload the ammunition and load the remainder of the kit, of my kit. In the meantime, I'd sent the men on ahead. I'd managed to commandeer yet another landing craft. There was a small thing, a small LCVP, onto which we managed to squeeze in all the soldiers, bar about half a dozen, including myself. I stayed ashore. And we sent all these forward onto Sir Galahad. The remainder of us helped, and we manhandled, and we pushed, and we pulled, and we got all the kit and all the vehicles onto the Mexi float. We then started to motor out to Sir Galahad, which was about a mile away from where we were, further up the San Carlos water. And as we were going along, we were getting radio messages from Sir Galahad telling us to be quicker. In fact, we'd had several messages while we were loading saying, I am sailing at 9 o'clock. These were Zulu time, it was 900 Zulu, 2100. And we said, no, we won't be packed by then. Give us a little longer. And then we got another message back saying 2200. And the final one said, you must be loaded by 2300, because I am sailing at midnight. In fact, we didn't arrive at Galahad until, I think it was about 20 past 11, 23:20. We arrived, and I said to the coxswain, right, go around the back of the ship, and we'll start loading through the rear bay, the big rear tank door. And the message came from Sir Galahad, no, you will draw up alongside, and you will load over the side. We cannot open the back door. And I said to the coxswain, well, all right, you can pull up the time being, but keep your engines running because you're going around the back. And before, in fact, I hadn't realized, it's only later that I began to get a gold sweat when I thought about it, but the Mexi float was very heavily loaded, and I was standing right on the side, ready to jump off onto the ladder to go up the side of Galahad. And of course, yes, you don't know, I'm an inveterate coward. I'm terrified of heights, and a ship with a ladder down the side looks like a skyscraper if you're at the sea level. And I was ready to jump off onto this ladder, and the coxswain kept saying, sir, get away from that gap. If you go through there, you'll be squashed, you know. And of course, the thing was getting closer and closer, and the water was splashing up, and I was only intent on getting on this ladder. And I got on the ladder, and I was up it like a rat up a drainpipe, and got to the top, found a ship's officer, an RFA ship's officer, and said, right, we've got to open the back door. No, you can't do that, Colonel. He said, I've got people sleeping downstairs. I said, I don't care. I don't give a damn. Doesn't matter. Open the door. And anyway, after a short discussion, the back door was opened, and the coxswain took the Mexi float round the back. The reason they didn't want to open the back door was because they had two companies of Welsh guardsmen who were all asleep. They had been moving for days. They had marched 12 miles in pouring rain. They'd then been brought back again and then lagered up for another day. Then they'd gone out in the rain again. They were sodden and their feet were bad. They were in a terrible state and they were asleep on the tank deck. And this is why, of course, they didn't wish to open the rear tank door, because that opened straight onto the tank deck and all these chaps were sleeping there. However, I was able to go down and discuss this with the company commanders, the two Welsh Guards company commanders. I told them that I had a Mexi float full of kit, that there was no way of offloading it. Certainly we couldn't do it by the cranes on the Galahad, which was the intention, and that it would have to be man-packed, and that I could offer 90 blokes to help, but that I would certainly need their assistance, the Welsh Guards' assistance, by moving out of the way, and any assistance in moving would be appreciated too. They said they'd prefer to do it themselves, that they could command their own soldiers better, and that my boys could stand aside and the Welsh Guards would show me how to unload. And bless their hearts, they did. And they managed to offload the Mexi, in fact, in 1 hour, 5 minutes. And since it had taken us 6 hours to load it with eager beavers, it's quite amazing what 140 manpower. In fact, there were 340 Welsh Guards there, but I think only one company, in fact, did the offloading. And it's amazing how quickly they did it. While this was going on, while this loading was taking place, I'd gone up to the bridge and I'd met the ship's master, Phil Roberts, in fact. And he had said he was unhappy to sail anymore because it was too late, that he couldn't see us offloading or being ready to sail till at least 2 o'clock in the morning, which would mean it would be bright sunlight by the time we arrived at Fitzroy, which clearly was not in our interest. And in fact, he signalled to force headquarters to the effect that he intended to stay the night at San Carlos. Well, be that as it may, we were overruled, and the ship, in fact, did sail that night. I think we actually weighed anchor about 1:30 in the morning. As we sailed out of San Carlos water, and we turned left to go southwards down Falkland Sound, it's a very eerie feeling indeed, because the sleet and the rain had all stopped. It suddenly became a beautifully clear night. Somebody has said that in the Falkland Islands you can get all four seasons in one day, and this is absolutely true. And this particular night, it was absolutely crystal clear. There was a beautiful bright moon. The Navy, I am convinced, and I count among the Navy the Royal Fleet Auxiliaries as well, I'm convinced that they paint their ships in reflective pale paint, because I was sure that here we had one target busy sailing down the narrow sound, because Falkland Sound is at its most only 10 miles wide, and at some places it gets down to 2 miles, I think. And we knew that there were enemy on West Island, and we sailed within 2 or 3 miles of Port Howard, where we knew there was an enemy brigade. Very eerie feeling, and Roger and I were leaning over the rear gate saying just this. Why did the Navy have to paint their ships so bright? Why couldn't they paint their ships dark blue? Would have been far better. And wear bright grey uniforms, you know, it seemed the wrong way around. However, we sailed on, and we then went to bed, and we got up the next morning to the most beautiful dawn, I think, that I've seen, certainly the most beautiful that we saw on the islands. And of course that boded ill, because we know about the air threat. We didn't like that terribly. We arrived at Fitzroy, I call it Fitzroy Sound, I think it's actually called Port Pleasant, but it's the little bay that leads into Fitzroy Settlement. It is not Bluff Cove, which has appeared in all the national press, where actually nothing happened. It's Fitzroy. And we pulled into there, I think we dropped anchor around about 11 o'clock, 11:30 in the morning. And then, to our amazement, firstly, there were no ships to meet us. We could see Tristram, Sir Tristram, a couple of hundred yards away, further up the bay, and we could see the little houses of Fitzroy Settlement. But then, to our amazement, there was nothing to meet us to offload. Then a Mexi float arrived, not a large Mexi float like the one I'd seen the night before, but a small Mexi float. It arrived, but amazingly, it was loaded solidly with ammunition. And I thought, my God, this is a nightmare. I saw this last night at San Carlos. But sure enough, there it was. And the chap pulled up to the back gate, and the coxswain said, I can take 9 men. And we said, this is absurd, you must go away, unload this ammunition quickly, please, and come straight back. And in fact, I said to him, no, it's all right, there's a landing craft behind you, an LCU. No, sir, he said, that's full of ammunition too. And in fact, that arrived, and indeed it was full of ammunition. And I said the same thing to him. Go ashore once, and for God's sake, unload that ammunition very, very quickly and come back. We have got 340 guardsmen to shift, and we have a whole field ambulance. And these two disappeared, the Mexi float and the LCU, and they didn't reappear for nearly 4 hours. By which time, the people in the tank deck were getting very tired, standing, waiting to be moved. A lot of the guardsmen, a lot of my soldiers, had gone upstairs back into the canteens and were sitting watching video films. And then one of the LCU, in fact, came back, the landing craft came back. I'd had a discussion, initially a very friendly discussion, with the senior guards officer there, at which he fully agreed that when the first landing craft came, I should take it, go ashore, see brigade headquarters and explain the situation to them and say that we required, in fact I suggested to him that I would see to it that we got helicopters to move the guardsmen to Bluff Cove, because to take them in the LCUs, which was going to take 3 hours per round trip and they would need two trips, would mean that they would arrive late that night in the dark, tired, and we believed that the offensive was due to start. We didn't know exactly when the timings were. So I said I'd go ashore first and fix up the helicopters, and he agreed to this. As the time wore on, and the hour became 2 hours, then 3 hours, and finally 4 hours, he became less and less happy about it, and we had, unfortunately, a disagreement as to who should take the first ship, and I insisted on taking it to do exactly as I said before, which was to go and arrange the helicopters. Maybe the helicopters I then went to arrange were the ones that turned up later. I don't know. I suspect they were. Because I'd hardly been ashore more than half an hour, three-quarters of an hour at the most, I would think. I'd gone up to the medical centre that we intended to set up. I'd looked at the community centre. I'd seen all the para soldiers in there with their trench feet. I'd told them to move. We'd arranged that that's where the surgery was going to go. And we'd done all that when, of course, the air attack took place.